Are you ready to grow your business, build wealth, and spark transformation in the South Suburbs of Chicago? Visit southlanddevelopment.org today and sign up for our newsletter to stay connected, get resources, and be the first to hear about the Achieve Summit, where entrepreneurs, developers, investors, and changemakers come together to ignite growth and opportunity. Don't just watch change happen, be a part of it. Join the movement at southlanddevelopment.org and start building your legacy today.
In this special edition of The First Million Is Always the Hardest, we break bread with Marine veteran Marco Estrada, exploring how veterans are becoming one of America's most driven and untapped sources of entrepreneurial talent.
First of all, thank you. And for the benefit of our viewers, tell everybody your name. Tell us about your business.
Sure. My name is Marco Estrada. I own Valor Jiu-Jitsu. It's a martial arts academy in Orland Park.
All right. And we got connected because of the work that we do with Business Growth Services and the Southland Development Authority. But one of the reasons in particular that I wanted to get a chance to talk to you is because we are real believers that there is a population in the United States that's underrepresented as entrepreneurs, but actually have some of the most perfect skill sets to be entrepreneurs, and they're veterans. And so part of our conversation to do is talking about your experience prior to being in the military, your experience in the military, and then how you transitioned from the military to the work that you're doing now as an entrepreneur. And really eager to hear your story. So I'd love for you just to kind of start, you know, at the beginning. You're from this area.
Yeah.
So tell a little bit about your story and how you ended up getting to the military and going on from there. And I'll interject at various points.
Sure. Okay. So I was born and raised in the south side of Chicago.
I'm assuming that means you are a White Sox fan.
That is correct. Absolutely.
That is a good answer.
That's your answer. I am.
We cheer for the Cubs when they're winning.
I will tell you, I couldn't name a single player in the White Sox right now, but just by virtue of me being a Southsider, I'm always going to root for them and not the Cubs.
Right.
So, having been born and raised on the South Side of Chicago, very similar to a lot of those that were in the neighborhood.
Right.
Like me, I grew up in a neighborhood called Little Village. If you're familiar with the city at all, it's a pretty rough area. Very much aligned with the statistics that were there, raised by a single mom, raising three boys. My father was extremely violent. My father was a heroin addict. And in fact, my first steps were literally in a prison, coming to daddy.
Right.
Come to dad, and I walked to him. So I felt that, like, I was raised with this understanding and kind of belief that I was genetically predisposed to do what my father did and his father before him.
Yeah.
So being raised in this neighborhood by a single mom, because by the time I was about three, my parents had been separated. By the time I was about five, they had officially been divorced.
Of course, yeah.
So he was still kind of coming around. And when I was seven, he was strung out. I was sick. And my mom and him had gotten into this altercation and said, hey, look, you need to stay with your mom because I got to go to work.
Yeah.
So they're staying by my grandmother's house. They had a fight. He ends up running her over.
Oh.
So he runs my mom over, breaks both of her legs. She's in a cast for the next 2 years. She's in casts from her toes to her thighs for the next 2 years. So I was seven. My little brother was six and my older brother was 11.
You all of a sudden, you were already probably father figure. Now you're kind of in charge of everything.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So we're broke. You know, we're living in a third floor apartment on the south side. And I remember, I mean, on a calendar, it's probably a lot of flips ago. But in my mind, I remember like it was yesterday and doing laundry in my bathwater. And so everything that came out of this woman went into a bedpan. And we cleaned
everything.
So we end up kind of living in this environment, and the neighbor next door, the way our apartment building was, we lived in a three flat. It was kind of recessed back from the sidewalk, and there was a house that was
came a little bit
kind of online with the sidewalk, right? So I remember coming out of my apartment and running across the yard because I seen a line of kids that were on the sidewalk and I didn't know what it was. The neighbors at times, they had this snow cone machine and they would sell snow cones for like a quarter. So I remember seeing a line. I thought they just had the snow cone machine out. So I'm running up to try and get in line. And I see that the neighbor boy, one of the neighbors who had joined the Marines, was home on leave. So this home, when my father would come home and be extremely violent, we would take off out the run out the house, run out the back, and run next door. So this home I had always associated with safety and love and just security. So we had had this developed this affinity for the family and all the boys and girls. It was a large family. It was five boys and three girls.
Wow.
So I seen that Albert was home on leave. And as I come around the front, I kind of catch the full image of what's happening. And I see this line of all the neighborhood boys that are in line. Yeah. And Albert is at the stoop. And he's got one of the kids laying across his lap. And he's got his chest up. And he's got a pitcher of water. So I'm like, what the heck is going on here? I'm trying to assess what's going on. My little brain can't process what's happening. So I notice that the kid is basically getting water poured in his mouth and he gets up and he's, I later find out it's called waterboarding.
Yeah. Right? For fun.
Yeah. So I see what's going on and I'm like, man, I want to try this. So I'm like, hey, I want next. I call next. So I go up. And I'm thinking I'm going to defeat this thing that's as old as time and warrior defeats it. So I lay out across his lap. He puts a rag across my mouth and he begins to pour. And just like you're supposed to, you start drinking until you can't drink anymore. And you inhale the water and you're drowning on dry land. So I'm coughing, I'm gasping for air. I sit up. And I said, Albert, what did you learn to do that? He said, in the Marines. I was 7 years old. I said, I want to do that.
That's a hell of a recruitment.
I want to be a Marine. It was then that I chose that I wanted to be a Marine.
Wow. That's an incredible story. There's a couple things you talked about that are important. And if you're uncomfortable with any conversation, you feel fine. But, many of us have, through our ancestors. So, first of all, it has been proven now scientifically that we carry the DNA of the experiences of our family going back between 11 and 15 generations. So the things that have happened to your mother, your grandfather, your great-grandfather, they are transitioned in part, smaller and smaller parts, through your DNA to you. So there is a line of both what I will call heirlooms, positive things that is in your family, things that you are good at that someone in your family has probably reflected over time. You may not have met that person, but it's there. And there are also hardships, a whole line of things that you have in your family that are genetic. And most of us spend a lot of time trying to ignore or run away from the hardships without actually acknowledging the heirlooms because people are complicated. My father was a great man, but my father was also alcoholic.
Yeah.
Right. And I tell people those two things can coexist. And I had to find some time and a way to forgive him for that side of his weakness without ignoring it and pretending that it wasn't there, but also acknowledging the heirlooms that he gave to me as well. Have you gotten to a place in your life where you feel like you could have that balance, with your experience with your father?
Yeah, absolutely. We eventually reconciled our relationship years later. But yeah, I feel definitely that I could. And I've learned a lot. It was one of the, when he got out of prison the last time, my brothers and I had already kind of immersed ourselves in our environment.
Yeah.
And I had already kind of had a couple of marks on my rap sheet, and there were some things that I was really kind of heading towards.
Yeah.
Obviously, the story that's as old as time, right? You get out of prison, and hey, don't do what I did.
Right.
Don't be like me. And from a distance, he began to kind of attempt to reconcile the relationship. We wanted nothing to do with him because we had gotten to an age where we really kind of understood what had occurred and really didn't want to have much to do with him.
Yeah.
Through his perseverance and just commitment of loving us, things continued to become volatile in the way we were living our lives. And my mom was like, hey, look, I'm ready to move on, and I'm going to go leave the state, and you either come with me or you're going to live with your father. And that was the ultimatum. And we were forced to kind of reconcile the relationship that we had with him because we didn't want to leave the city. So we were in this conundrum. It's like, I don't want to leave the city, but I don't want to live with him. Yeah. But that's kind of...
Maybe a little bit of genius on your mom's part.
Well, the other thing is, and we had some things that we had to work through because she was tired of raising three knucklehead boys that were getting in trouble all the time.
That's tough.
So she had to kind of put her life on hold for a long time, and then she was ready to move on with what she was doing. And it just felt like, hey, look, you're going to come with, or you're going to make your decisions.
Yeah.
And our decisions were made, and we ended up living with my father. It was the best thing that ever happened to us because he was smart. He was savvy. He knew exactly what we were doing.
Of course he did.
And he was
like, yeah, I did that.
He was the Lord. I could go on with stories that we had done and things that we had experienced, but he was the warden, and he knew what we were up to, and he did what he could to kind of mitigate some of that and do some damage control. Some still managed to get through,
of course,
but not everything.
Well, you're kids, so I mean, you're working hard.
That's right.
All the time.
That was our role. That was our job.
To figure it out. But I do think there is something to the fact I was raised by a single mom. My mother did a phenomenal job. She wasn't perfect, but she was perfect for me.
Sure.
Right. And, but there is something that's different about when you're especially a young teenage boy having that male figure around that I think is important, that I've experienced very much. So that's great to hear. So you get from this point, you see Albert, who's on the corner on the stoop with his Marine uniform on, and he's like, yeah, that's what I want to be.
Yeah.
But there was a process between that and getting to the Marines.
That's right.
Right? So, you know, between that, when you think back about your experience as a young person, other than being a Marine, what else did you think about that you aspired to potentially be or do when you were older?
So I really didn't have a lot. That always kind of stood in the back of my brain. We moved around quite a bit. I lived in the 8 years of attending grammar school, right?
Yep.
Here in Chicago, you go K through 8. I went to 6 different grammar schools.
Wow.
So we moved quite a bit for a number of different reasons, but primarily because my father was kind of the way he was. So we E&E'd quite a bit. We tried to escape and evade him. So we moved to Gary, Indiana. I lived in Gary, Indiana.
That's funny. We were talking about that.
Yeah. So I went to an all-black school where I stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yep.
And it was rough.
Gives you credibility, though.
It was rough. Then we came back to Chicago. We stood there for a couple of years and then moved to Florida.
Wow.
So my mother...
Where in Florida?
In Lakeland, Florida.
Okay.
So my mother's parents had retired and moved there. So we moved to Lakeland, Florida. It was kind of a retired community.
Yeah.
So we moved there, and the only people that looked like us were the ones that were selling oranges or picking oranges in the orange groves. So we experienced some cultural differences.
You went to two very extreme cultures.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it was different because I was being called names that I had never heard before.
Right.
And
you didn't think they were talking about you.
I did.
I've never heard that before.
Right. I'm from Chicago. But because I stuck out and I looked different, I was treated differently. So there was a lot of fighting that was going on because of these cultural clashes, right?
Yeah.
So we moved back to Chicago. And when we moved back, by the time that we moved back to Chicago, we were at an age where my oldest brother really began to kind of really start kind of setting roots quickly into the wrong crowd.
Yeah.
And just by virtue of the proximity we had in age and the affinity that we had for our big brother, we followed suit. So he started hanging out with the wrong crowd, as did I. My mom was still in a relationship kind of long distance with who eventually became our stepfather and would leave us home for weekends at a time sometimes.
Yeah.
And you know, idle time's the devil's time. It's exactly what we did. So began experiencing a lot of things that young boys should not be experiencing at that age, getting involved in things that young boys in that age should not be getting involved in, and got in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
So he was a junior in high school. I was in seventh grade, and we started getting into stuff that should not have been. So at the time, I think that to answer the question, is there wasn't really a whole lot of time for me to kind of dream.
Dream, yeah.
I was always in survival mode. I was always kind of wondering when we were going to move, if we were going to move. And I think now, even at my age now, it really kind of, as I look back, stymied my process because I almost didn't want to wish something.
Yeah.
Because if I didn't,
you don't want to not get it.
Exactly. And, yeah. That's exactly right. And it's only now I just had this kind of epiphany that even as an adult, I still find myself doing that sometimes. That's why you have no idea. Yeah. The conversation that you and I had downstairs, I was like, man, you have no idea what you're saying because there's the impact that it's having and how it's resonating with me because of these things that I've had internally, these voices in my head that I've been wrestling with since I was 7.
Yeah, all of us have. And just for the benefit of viewers, you know, those of you who've had a chance to listen to the podcast, particularly go back to the Zero trailer where I kind of talk a little bit about why the name of this podcast is The First Million is Always the Hardest, but I also talk a little bit about the psychological aspects. Almost all of us have moments where we're fighting fear and doubt. That's just natural. It's a common, but part of it is if you've been in a world where you've experienced so much disappointment, the first thing you want to do is to avoid the pain of disappointment.
That's right.
And the easiest way to do that is to not dream.
That's right.
That way I can't be disappointed. If I don't expect to win or I don't expect to get this or I don't expect to have that, then I can't be disappointed by it. And there's some truth to that, right? It's not all wrong, but it also means that you're only being half of who you are.
Yeah.
Right? Because all of us have aspirations. It's just natural, right?
Sure.
And so part of it is we have to train ourselves again to not just dream, but to put ourselves in a place where we can have agency, control over moving closer to that dream. It's not about achieving the dream. It's taking the step closer.
Sure, sure.
Right? And every time we take a step and it gets closer and closer and closer, we build the level of confidence that we can actually start moving faster towards that dream and eventually get to that place. The idea of having control is the difference. And most of the people that I know that have actually decided to go to the military, what changed in them was it wasn't just all of the discipline and this and that. It was that the discipline gave them a sense of control.
Yeah.
And the sense of control allowed them to actually create paths to move in the direction that they wanted to move. And that was really what was different. They're really the same person.
Yeah.
Except they have control and they feel they have that agency. And I'm just curious, based on your experience, you know, going from you as a, you know, sometimes troubled teenager, and you already shared, but not for everyone listening, that at an early age, you decided to get married. And then you decided that I'm going to go into the military. Just as you think about what I'm describing and that sense of control and how you dealt with your own self-doubt, how did all those things come in? It's, you know, to get married at a young age, there's no doubt, right? You were 100% certain. And maybe that is a form of, you know, you just knew that this was the right person. And there's something about that decision that is so definite that's a first step maybe towards getting you to a place where you're like, I can control my life. I can make these sorts of decisions.
Well, I think there was enough, given my limited experience and understanding of what marriage was, because it had never really even been modeled to me.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? So I had seen a couple of different aunts and uncles or, you know, my parents' siblings that had had semi-pseudo-healthy relationships, right? They were still together.
And what you saw on TV, right?
Right. But they were still together. And to me, that, I guess, meant success, right? Because they weren't divorced. So to me, it was like, if you're together, that's success. If you're not, that's what kind of defined success, is that you're still married. So there were a couple of those that I had kind of had an understanding and witnessed. But I think as you begin, at the age that I got married, I was 19, right? She was 18. She got married, graduated high school, and turned 18 all in the same week.
Wow.
Right? So within our...
That's a hell of a party.
it was a fast and furious
week. Yeah, that's a hell of a party.
within our feeble understandings of what marriage was, right?
Right.
Because there was some kind of dysfunction within her parents, they were married and together, but there was still some dysfunction, right, just like a lot of other families.
Most.
So, yeah. So we didn't really combined have the perfect understanding of what it was. So even our aspirations of, hey, yeah, we're going to get married, it's going to be perfect, it was like, look, we know enough to say we want to take a shot at it.
Yeah.
She was pregnant, or she had already had my son. She was pregnant at 16, had him at 17. She was a senior in high school when she had my son. I had already gone on to the Marine Corps. I'm a year ahead of her.
Yeah.
So we already had our son, and it was just like, hey, look, that's kind of the criteria, right?
Right.
Like, you already got my kid.
We're almost there, right?
So I kind of like you. I think you kind of like me.
Yeah. Good start.
We want to take a shot at this.
And better than many.
Let's go. So it was enough, right? And I think that just like in any marriage, the byproduct of it, of working at it, is that you get better at it.
Absolutely.
And you want to do better at it, right? So my wife and I now celebrate the Institute of Marriage. We celebrate it with other couples. We have a few couples that we hang out with, love dearly, raised our kids together, and now raising grandkids together.
Right?
So we went from kids ourselves to now having grandkids and raising grandkids together with our peer group.
That's amazing. I've got one grandkid.
I've got one and a second on the way.
And I'm excited about her.
And that's why I'm here to see you, because we're going to have a granddaughter. So I need first million, because it's going to be expensive.
Well, of course, you can't say no. For daddy, sure. Your magical words.
That's right.
In any language.
That's right.
You know, it's interesting. When you were just talking about the experience of not knowing everything, but having to make a decision, and just to relate it back to just general work, you know, I had a conversation with some folks on my staff, and they were asking about how do you know when you've made a good decision. One of the things I talk about in the podcast is the difference between a reckless risk, you know, mm-hmm, and a calculated risk.
Yeah, for sure.
And one of the things that I really hold to, and I'm sure I stole this from someone but don't know who, is that most decisions are made between 65 and 85% knowledge. And actually, if you know more than 85%, you probably took too long to make that decision.
Agreed.
If you know less than 60%, you probably are not informed enough. But somewhere in that 65 to 85% range is where the vast majority of decisions should be made. And like you described it, yeah, well, we've been dating, we got married, we like each other, I like you, we should probably go ahead and do this.
Yeah.
I think there's something to that, and it really does end up resonating, thank you. It ends up resonating in the context of also work and the way you made your decisions. I mean, both how you've made some of your decisions. Look at that purple.
Genius.
That is serious business.
For you.
Thank you. This isn't a sponsored message. It's just what's worked for us. At the Southland Development Authority, we've been using Bill.com for the past 5 years to handle our invoicing and payment processing. For a small but growing organization like ours, it's been a game changer, saving us time, keeping us organized, and making sure payments go out and come in smoothly. It's simple, reliable, and cost-effective. Most importantly, it's freed us up to focus on the work that really matters, serving our community and growing our impact. If you're looking for a better way to handle payments, Bill.com has been the right fit for us.
You're listening to The First Million is Always the Hardest. We are now returning to the show.
I'm going to come back to that at some point in our conversation. But it strikes me that to some degree, given the conversations we've had already, that same principle of, I don't know 100%, but I know enough to know that this is the time to make this decision.
Yeah.
Partially drew you to the Marines, partially drew you to your deployments. If you don't mind talking a little bit about that too.
Sure.
While we eat. That gives me a chance to eat first and then maybe you get
it. But I think one of the things that even before we started this, we had talked about, right, in conversations prior, is having, and that's kind of the percentage that I kind of landed on. And I'm sure that was in some kind of Marine Corps doctrine.
Right? I'm sure I stole it from someone.
Yeah. It was 80% baked plan violated or executed violently is going to go over better than 100% perfectly planned.
Absolutely.
Executed poorly.
Exactly.
So I think as long as you have enough information to go on, then you're going to do well.
Yeah.
But the question again,
So just as you were making the decision to go into the military.
Sure.
And you had kind of gotten to the point of, this is in part my aspiration.
Yeah.
I've seen Albert. He came back. I like the shiny suit. He's learned some skills. I can leverage this. Sure. I'm married now, and I need to find a way to provide for my family. But I'm sure there's some other things that were running through your mind about what that experience of the Marine Corps was going to be for you. But you had to actually boil it down and make a decision.
Yeah.
I guess, how did you go through the process of making that decision?
So a lot of the decision was already kind of made for me, right? Which is the unique thing about being in the military, is that a lot of those decisions are kind of provided. You just have to kind of choose, right? Yeah. So the solutions are there. You just have to kind of pick which one you want to take and take a risk on.
Yep.
So I had been in the Marine Corps for about a year when I had come home. I had come home, spent some time with my wife, who was my recently, newly minted wife.
Right.
And even before that, I had the proposal. I'll refrain from saying how I proposed to her because it's just embarrassing. To this day, it's embarrassing. But I remember calling her on the phone, and this was in 1993, so we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have it was a phone center on the base that you pay for minutes, and you get in a booth and you call her.
I got 2 minutes, baby.
and I paid for 10, and it was so. I remember telling her, like, look. I'm not getting out. I'm not getting out of this gun club. I love it. I liked it because no one knew anything about me except for what I told them. In the Marine Corps, particularly in the infantry, I was a young infantryman.
That's freedom.
Yeah, it's exactly what it was. So I knew where I had come from. And because of the background that I had come from and these new people, this new circle of people that I had been exposed to now, it was almost kind of like this light that was shined upon me. And it's like coming out of a tunnel. You live in darkness. You come out of this tunnel, and now you come out and you see how soiled you are.
Right.
So when I'm in this environment of all these people that have these completely different life experiences, and now I'm exposed to them, I'm like, man, well, my life wasn't like that. You didn't grow up with the same background I did.
Right.
You don't look like me. You don't talk like me. You don't have the same thought process I did.
Yeah.
So there was a little bit of shame that came with that. And I remember thinking, like, I'm not getting out. And I wanted to almost feel, I think part of the marriage idea was also kind of like, I'm rescuing, like, we're getting the heck out.
Yeah.
You're my girl, and we're moving on. We're getting out, and we're going to take part of this big green machine, and we're going to take a ride.
Yeah.
And I don't care what's happening, right? So we're going to risk it together. So when I came home, we got married. So that's where we've got my little guy. Married, high school, 18, and then I was off and I deployed. Came back, she came out to live with me. So now she's
on the base.
So yeah, she was 19. I was 20 by that time. She was 19. Our son was one.
Yeah.
And we're living life on base in Hawaii.
Yeah.
So we did that for a couple of years, and then got to a point. It's like, all right, what are we gonna do?
Yeah.
Now, again, this whole landscape that I've been exposed to, I start seeing all these different things that I've never been exposed to or seen before. I'm getting introduced to these new ideas, and I was like, hey, what if I re-enlisted? Because now I'm introduced to these career Marines, these guys that are in charge of me. I hear about these illustrious stories that they've experienced.
And it's real.
And I want to do it too. And so she said, yeah, I guess let's stay in. So I re-enlisted. We go to sunny California, and move from Hawaii to Southern California. So from there, again, I began to kind of get – and that's what it was. It was just a series of decisions that kind of led me to new experiences, a new understanding of what the Marine Corps had to offer.
Yeah.
And then I just took a risk on it. And let's go here and let's try this. And what if we do this? And I tell you, I really am just grateful that I didn't make a bad choice, because I wanted to go different ways, but there was no bad choices, right? It seemed like looking at this menu here that there was nothing bad on the menu.
Did you ever consider not going to the Marines and going to another?
No, never. Never considered any other branch.
So I'll tell this story and give you a chance to heal a little bit, but we were talking a little bit downstairs. Interestingly, that you don't have a lot of military in your background. I've had a good number of folks in the military in my background. Most recently, my oldest son, Gabriel, who's in the Air Force Intelligence. And when he was going through his process, he had already gone to college. He had already traveled the world to a large extent. He was a licensed broker, had been in business doing some things, but wanted to serve. And we were fortunate enough that he allowed me to participate in his process and study and learn a little bit about each of the different forces. And we looked at everything, you know, Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, Marines, Space Force wasn't out at that point, but probably would have looked at that as well. And went through kind of a real analysis about what his experience was going to be and what he was going to get out of it and what he could provide to it. And I'm really grateful that we got to go through that process. I don't know how many people get to do that. We got recruited by a lot of different groups. And we were substantially influenced, like you were, by Albert. We were influenced by Alberto, which is a cousin who is a Marine, in fact, and was at Lejeune. He's actually in South Carolina now. And he had spent his career as a Marine from New York, living mostly in Japan. So, you know, we had Marines in the family. We also, my grandfather was a officer in the Army. He was a rifleman instructor in Mississippi in the 40s for World War II.
Wow.
And, you know, one of the things I shared before, you know, my grandfather was an incredible, incredible man. But, you know, he was from Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
I've been there.
Yeah. Great town and good food. You know, and even though he was an officer in the military, when he got out of World War II, you know, he still wasn't allowed to vote in Mississippi. You know, couldn't go to the school that he wanted to go to be a dentist. So he ended up actually working for the Postal Service, which ended up being great for him. But, you know, after having served honorably, you know, that was kind of what his life experience was after World War II. You know, that generation that we talk about as the greatest generation. I have my grandfather, I have my uncle, Sidney, who also served, actually was in France, was part of the team that repaired all of the tanks that were used for fighting in France. My uncle T.H., which is actually my grandfather's brother, is a lifer in the Air Force. And so when you looked around in our family, we had, you know, a lot of the different services where we had representation and had people who had lived and worked with the military for a long period of time. So it kind of gave some perspective for Gable to kind of really think through what was going to be the best, you know, for him. He wasn't as singularly focused as you were, but his experience had been a positive one. Broadly, you know, nothing's perfect, but overall I've been really good. And it really, I think, gave our whole family real respect for what it is to be in the military, especially have a family in the military, the requirements of having to travel around and move and raise your kids. You know, it's a real sacrifice. And so, you know, I find it, I'm always struggling because I feel like saying thank you for the service is just not nearly enough, you know, but I mean this sincerely. Thank you for your service. And having had family in my family who served, I really feel that as an important part. Even in instances where we don't agree with the policies, there's still importance in serving. So I say all of that because this episode is particularly focused on what I think is a, not hidden, but a major resource, which is veterans. To solve one of our major issues in the United States, which is who's going to take over all these businesses that the baby boomers, who did serve in many cases in Vietnam or earlier, or got out of the military. And I know you did several tours. Talk a little bit about what you thought about in your job prospects. How did you process life after the Marines?
Well, I'll give you a chance to eat too, right?
Yeah, right?
So I think that one of the... This is something that I really wrestled with. I mean, I wrestled some demons. And when I got out, I began working for Cook County's Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Mm-hmm. I got into the organization. I worked here. I started off as the chief of logistics. We grew an organization. That's why even when you were talking earlier, again, we began to scale this business.
Yeah.
That's what it was. It was an organization that grew. As Cook County's Department of Homeland Security, we provided an echelon of service that never existed. So where the 134 municipalities that lie within Cook County had someone to go to rather than having to surpass the county and going directly to the state of, of Illinois Emergency Management Agency. So we provided this service, and it became a national best practice. So we went from about 12 to easily 50, 60 people in about 4 years.
Wow.
So from that, I was promoted from chief of logistics to I became deputy director, became part of the executive staff for the county, all while simultaneously going to school. So I went to college because getting out at 38, retired, this friend that was a very good friend, he's still a friend of mine now, who had met when I was on active duty, was kind of a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And he's who I worked for because he was part of the organization's leadership when I got in. He was
at Homeland Security.
Yep. Mm-hmm. He was a Chicago police officer. He was a lieutenant in CPD who had taken a leave of absence and came over to the county.
Yeah.
He was part of the executive staff and responsible for creating this organization. So I was part of the recruitment that came in, screened, vetted, went through the interview process, hired on, and then we began to build this national best practice. So we pioneered this organization and essentially 5X'd it, right? In terms of capability and personnel, it was just something that had never really been done before. So it was great because I went from the Marine Corps to this organization.
Mm-hmm.
Now, prior to my getting on the job, there was a bit of a delay to actually get in. So in between there, I worked for the anti-terrorist awareness organization that was formerly known as Blackwater. So it was an independent contractor working for, they had changed their name by that time, called Academy. I had worked as an independent contractor for the Department of State, as an instructor doing dignitary protection for foreign dignitaries for the country of Kenya.
Yep.
So from Marine Corps, jumped to the Department of State. From there, come here to Homeland Security. It was there that my good friend decided to lovingly and affectionately point a gun at me and say, look, you're going to school. You need to take your butt to school.
Yeah.
So at gunpoint, I agreed. I succumbed to the idea. While at a presentation of a school, I go to school. The next three years of my life were fast and furious. I had gotten out, started working in August. By January, I was enrolled in school full time. So I'm trying to work, coach, be a good dad, be a good husband. And I actually was in the police academy. I was through the Illinois State Law Enforcement and Training Standards Board, through LETSB and NEMR. I was taking a part-time police academy. So for the first 9 months of being in school full-time, I'm also in a part-time police academy. So
you are fast and furious with that. There's a lot going on.
So every other Saturday, I'm at the academy. Three, four nights a week, I'm going to school, trying to be a dad, do homework, all of the good stuff, coaching. I did that for 3 years. Took the summer off, went to grad school, was University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. I got my MBA.
Congratulations, man.
I got my executive MBA through University of Illinois in Champaign. And from there, I was like, okay, hey, look, I've done everything that I was supposed to have done, right? Like, I'm looking down the list of what I think that I'm supposed to do,
right?
Like, I feel for some reason I've got these kind of...
You caught up by then.
Yeah.
You had done all the stuff and caught up.
That was what I had believed, right? And this is where the hardship began.
Yeah.
So, and the heartache, right? And heartbreak, because... here I am. I get out. I'm civilly serving, working for a local municipal government, right? I'm serving as a police officer part-time, right? Literally. So I have a part-time badge now for South Chicago Heights as a police officer. I'm now working a full-time job. So some things changed in the landscape at Homeland Security. I end up leaving.
Yeah.
I'll refrain from saying how and why, but after grad school, I chose to say, okay, hey, look, I need to get out of this government sector, public sector work, and try and do this corporate America thing. So I went and worked for Walgreens. So I was working corporate security at Walgreens, was there for about 2 years.
Yeah.
The first year was great. I mean, both years were great. There was just some issues that really kind of pulled me away. Again, I felt like I just needed more. I needed more.
Yeah.
The first year I did the corporate security program. I ran the corporate security, worked for a tremendous leader, guy by the name of, I'll just refrain from saying his name, but great guy, former CIA agent, really good guy. Worked for him for about a year, said, hey, there's another opportunity. Why don't you apply for that? Apply for that. I took that job over.
Yep. Still at Walgreens.
Still at Walgreens. We ran the Global Security Operations Center, 9,300 stores fusing in one 24-hour center that I ran. Great job, but they never backfilled my other position. So I had two full-time jobs for nearly a year.
Wow.
Right around that time.
Being paid for one, of course.
That's right. Exactly. So I'm saving them a salary, working my butt off, sometimes getting 2-3 phone calls a night because of things that are happening across the country. And Bo, I'll tell you, the stock of Walgreens never changed because I answered that damn phone.
When you left them, they probably hired two people.
They had to.
Right.
They had to.
So what's amazing is that people don't see that at the time.
Right.
You know? And one of the things we talk about here is recruiting good people.
Yeah.
When you see that they're good, it's not about money, but it is about kind of getting people to a place where they feel appreciated.
Yeah.
Money's usually a part of that appreciation, but it's not the only part of that appreciation.
Sure. Yeah, and so I went to a job. I had befriended somebody through the relationship management that I had. Mm-hmm. Right, I was managing vendors, and this individual company had a contract through the GSA, the General Services Administration, and the U.S. Marshal Service. And they said, hey, Marcos, we know your background, education, experience. We'd love for you to come join our team and help us build this. Okay, so I got an understanding of what they were working with. Got an understanding of what they were doing, and I let my MBA go to work.
Yeah.
Right? And the drive and understanding and tenacity that I did with everything else the by which I lived, the vigor by which I lived, along with my education and experience, I put it together, 4X that company. So I began to grow. And so I left Walgreens, went to work for this company, and it got to a point where I was the number two IC, right? I was the second guy in charge. The owner and I just really didn't see eye to eye about reinvestment and where to put money. We agreed to kind of disagree and part ways. So I went back to my old love and went back to contracting. So I was training cops across the country, doing stuff overseas. I was in Ukraine last summer.
Mm-hmm.
I was there a few years prior.
That's a story in and of itself.
Yeah. So I've seen some places.
Yeah, you have.
Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia. I was responsible for the evacuation of the U.S. I was part of the team that evacuated the U.S. Embassy in Monrovia, Liberia, Africa.
Wow.
Did work with the Kenyans. Did work in El Salvador, Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria.
Wow.
Ukraine twice. Spoke at Counterterrorism Expo in South Korea. So I've been around a little bit.
Yeah.
From the south side of Chicago to doing some pretty cool things, right? But all of that to say this, right? Going back to what you asked, I still had difficulty finding a job.
Yeah,
I could not find a job. When I left Homeland Security, and I was before I got to Walgreens, I stopped counting at 300.
Yo, that's so painful.
So here I am. So on paper, I'm this guy that 20 years in the Marine Corps. Decorated a war vet because I was decorated for valor both in Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's where the name comes from, valor.
So there, that's right. So there are billboards, literally billboards in the city of Chicago, all over Chicago, with my face on it. I could show you pictures.
Yeah.
Through this thing that they had going through the recruiting station, a hometown hero was a campaign that they had.
Yep.
So I'm all over. I'm decorated for valor. I've got an executive MBA from a Big Ten college.
Yeah.
I was part of the executive staff in the second largest county in America, and I can't find a job. I settled for taking a job making $17 an hour working part-time.
Yeah.
At Marine Valley
Community College. And that's demoralizing for a lot, especially because you were making that kind of money in the Marines. Better.
I was making, I went $17 an hour. So now I've got a home, I've got children, I've got
yeah, I can't
I had
survive.
A career. I had a career. I was part of the executive staff. I'm making decisions.
Which is part of the reason why a lot of folks go back into the military. You know, that it's a perfect segue because there's a few things that you said that I really want to address. You know, I don't think you were unusual in this feeling that you had, which was that I need to catch up. Right. All these people are ahead of me.
Yeah.
Which we all feel at times. But I have found a lot of my friends who are in the military feel that excruciatingly. And largely because one of the things that people who aren't in the military or haven't had a military family, you know, people have a misconception about who's in the military. It's a pretty diverse group of people who's in the military.
That's right.
There's a lot of hoity-toity people in the military. You know, like I went to Harvard Business School, and we always had a lot of guys that were out of the military that were in Harvard Business School.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you're meeting folks who come from backgrounds where they had gone to West Point. The only way to have gone to West Point as a congressman had to actually have written you a recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to have been someone when you were a teenager who a congressman was actually willing to sponsor, which typically is somebody who's got some level of connection.
Mm-hmm.
Not always, very often.
Yeah.
You're in with guys who have got a history where their parents have been in the military for a long period of time. And there's a kind of a different standard of how they get treated as
right.
a result. And then you got folks who, like, it was either the military or it was jail, and I just chose the military, right? So it's a wide range of people that are there, but you're experiencing how dramatically different everything is for these people, where right. they've come from, how they grew up, you know, what their expectations are. And I think for a lot of people, like in any experience, it's jarring, you know? But the other thing you said that I want to come back to, it's really interesting, is you got a chance to kind of remake yourself.
Yeah.
Right? These people don't know who you are.
Right.
So you get to tell them who you are, as opposed to have them assume about you who you are. And there's a lot of power that comes with, I can make myself into the person that I want to be.
Sure.
It's kind of a first step of control being in that environment, because all they know is that, well, I know, you know, Marcos is good soldier,
right.
you know, he's a reliable dude, and I trust him, and I don't need to know all the other stuff about him.
Right.
I know from this point on about him, and that frames how I relate and I deal with him. Now, you spent how many years, 20 years?
Yeah.
In that environment where you had earned your respect day to day with all of your activity, but then you come out, and all of a sudden, there's a whole different filter that's being used to evaluate
that's right.
everything that you did.
That's right.
Right? And my experience with my family and peers who've been in the military and they come out is it's jarring. It's almost kind of like you say thank you for my service, but you don't even appreciate my service because you don't understand what it meant that I did supplies for 30,000 troops, you know, here in Afghanistan. You don't know what that meant.
Right.
So you don't really appreciate it. You can only think of me in one context when if I'm supplying that many people every single day whose lives depend on me getting them food and water, there's a lot of things that I could be doing.
Right.
But you have to be willing to actually be a little creative to assess that role with what you have in corporate America. And I think that's where the disconnect happens for a lot of people.
And what I did was coming out, I had assumed like, okay, well, hey, look, I want to provide that filter. I want to get that filter, right? So I pursued this education because I thought that that's what I needed.
Mm-hmm.
To catch up to my peer group, right? Here, right. I'm in my early 40s now.
You were already ahead of your peer group. You just didn't realize.
Well, I guess, right? But at the same time, in terms of credential and qualifications, that's not the lens that corporate America saw me through. So I felt, okay, look, I've got to catch up with them. I've got to do what it is that's going to be necessary so that I can be seen the same way
right.
as them. The problem is that I had felt that I had still been seen with all these blemishes. Like, well, you did 20 years in the Marine Corps. You're an infantry guy. You didn't grow up in this space.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of criteria, based on what you've made, decisions you've made, teams you've led, assets you've managed, decisions, all of these things, right? People, personnel, and equipment that you've managed, oversaw, supervised, whatever, led. By criteria, you should be
right.
director, senior director, VP in some cases, depending on the size of the company. But no one would hire me as a director of sales because I didn't grow up in sales. No one would hire me as a director of HR because I didn't grow up in HR space. Right. Whatever is fill in the blank. No one would hire me at that level because I didn't grow up in that space, in that line. Right. Yeah. So, okay, great. That's fine. I'll take a haircut to get in. But then it's like, oh, you're too senior.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So here I'm in this conundrum because right. I find myself.
Neither here nor there.
Right. So
I'm willing to start at the bottom, but you won't even let me.
Because I'm a flight risk.
Right.
Well, you'll find something better and then you'll leave us.
Maybe. But that's not a reason to be scared.
But that's what I have. That's where I found myself in the problem because here I felt I was doing everything right.
Yeah.
Here I felt I was doing everything what everybody expected of me. And it wasn't enough.
Yeah. So well, that's disheartening. And but we're going to turn that into an opportunity.
Sure.
You know, and I shared with you earlier, you know, I have this driving effort, which is, you know, we have a major, we have multiple issues that are happening in the country right now from an economic standpoint. But one of them is the greatest generation that the baby boomers, they're retiring. And they're retiring in droves, 10,000 a day. And they're actually the largest owners of individual businesses in the country. But there's a problem. Only 1 in 10 of baby boomers actually can sell their business for different reasons. Some of their businesses are not ready to be sold. Some of them are not even interested in selling their business. Most of them can't give their businesses to their children because their children are not interested in the business. And when they retire, they simply close up shop. We know of companies here in the Southland who had thriving businesses, 25, 30, 40-year-old businesses. When it came time for them to retire, they basically took the land, sold it, took any equipment they could, sold, gave away the rest of the equipment, fired their employees, many of whom had worked there 10, 15, 25 years, not because they didn't care about them,
right.
but because they couldn't continue to operate the business. And they picked up and they moved to Scottsdale, Arizona, or Tampa, Florida, which is where everybody seems to go from this area once they retire. And I cast no shame about that decision.
Yeah.
These are people who worked all their life and done all the right things that they were supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
right, to get to a point where they can actually retire. But that causes a lot of problems. First, we lose the revenue of those businesses. We lose the business of those revenue. And we have a lot of industries here in the Southland that are core to the entirety of the United States. Food manufacturing, distribution comes through here. Transportation logistics come through here. Metals and metals manufacturing, advanced manufacturing comes through here. So when those types of businesses in particular, but not exclusively, when they actually shut down, it isn't just that individual company that's impacted. It's the entire ecosystem mm-hmm. in that group that's impacted in that business. And that's a real problem for us. But if we can figure out mm-hmm. how to take the 1 in 10 businesses that actually can sell and move that to 3 to 4 out of 10 businesses that sell, we can solve multiple problems at one time. We can not only help to fund Social Security, we can help baby boomers retire in a better state because they've sold their business and they've got this cash that they can use. We can actually keep people employed, right, which is important. So those businesses don't shut down. The people who are working there continue to work, continue to get paid. We can actually transition wealth from one generation to the next, which is extremely important right now. Generation X, Generation Millennial, Generation Z, these are all generations who actually need to have more of an ownership mindset. And the only way to get there is through acquisition. But we have to have businesses that are willing to sell to them. And we have to help educate those folks to be in a position. When I look at populations that make a tremendous amount of sense to be acquirers of these boomer businesses, I think in particular veterans are kind of in the top of that list. Not the exclusive, but really high level because of the experience that you just described.
Yeah.
And part of what we are hoping to do, and I'm personally hoping to do, is to make it easier for a lot of veterans to see themselves as entrepreneurs. And instead of having to think, I can only start this business from scratch and gut it out, to see themselves as acquirers.
Mm.
They can buy a business that does $500,000 of operating profit, $2 million, $5 million of operating profit. This is a real possibility. So they're buying into businesses where they get a salary. You don't have to just start from the struggle. The struggle is helpful because if you have started and you struggled, you have total control. And often when you're in a position where you buy a business, you've got to get money from other people. So other people have some influence.
Sure.
But there's a balance. And, you know, all won't be right for some people, but a lot of stuff we can actually help people get to. And I really believe, as opposed to having to convince a company, a corporate system, that the experiences that you were having in the military are transferable to their business, I would rather spend time convincing financial companies, banks, that the experience that you had and the discipline that you've developed and the commitment that you've already demonstrated makes you a worthy candidate for a loan. Mm. And that just may mean some education, and it may mean help finding the companies for you to acquire. I just want to take a moment to say thank you. Thank you for listening, for letting us be a small part of your day, and for joining in these conversations that matter. This podcast isn't just ours, it's yours. We'd love for you to subscribe so you never miss an episode and join our community where you can share your own journey, your wins, and your lessons. And if there's someone whose story you think we should hear, tell us. We're listening. Thank you.
You're listening to The First Million is Always the Hardest. We are now returning to the show.
The reason to have this conversation with you is to learn about what was the process that you went through. And I'm projecting because I don't know this, but you've decided to start a business from scratch.
That's right.
But I want you to talk a little bit about kind of that process. And you shared with me a little bit earlier that you tried to get a loan, what that experience was like for you, who was in a position to actually help and educate you about what that process looks like, and talk a little bit about, you know, the business that you've started and kind of how you've had to figure out how to get that off the ground.
Yeah. I think just like most people that start a business, they think about what they feel they either enjoy or what they're good at.
Right.
So I've been part of the combat sports world for a couple decades. So I wrestled in high school competitively. I joined the Marine Corps when my first duty station, where I began to kind of really discover myself and who I wanted to be and what I liked doing. I was able to walk onto the Marine Corps Base Hawaii's freestyle team. So I began training, walked onto the team.
So don't make a mistake and pick a fight with you. That's what I hear right now.
So from there, when I went to Southern California, I had this, again, I had developed this kind of love and passion and affinity for wrestling. So I found a club that was nearby. I found a high school that was nearby. And during wrestling season, I'm looking to get into a room and kind of weasel my way into coaching, mentoring, developing young wrestlers and taking the experiences and lessons that I had learned and impart them in someone else. And I think it was kind of like, as a young Marine, you're particularly in the infantry, at a very young age, you're put into leadership positions. And in doing so, you either excel or you just kind of coast through it. I found that I had created, the Marine Corps created this kind of appetite in me for
leadership.
Yeah. And not just leading and being in charge of things, but developing, bringing people along, encouraging more.
That really is what leadership is, though.
Sure, absolutely. But in different capacities, right? So whether it's in a combat arms, whether you know it's a young fire team leader, a squad leader, or if it's as an instructor, right? Mm-hmm. And I began teaching and helping people develop skills, which was something that I had not really understood just yet, because it was just leading their role, their occupation, their job. I didn't see until I became an instructor, like, now I'm going to refine a very specific skill in you.
Right.
And that was how to
shoot. You need this, and I see this, and I'm going to put on a plan for you.
Right. So in every unit, you have qualifications. So and as a young Marine, I struggled with understanding the fundamentals of marksmanship.
Right.
But once I got it, I was like, man, I want other people to learn. So when I became an instructor, I now have this newfound passion for teaching people what I struggled
You're
with.
You're like, this is easy once it clicks.
It's exactly
like,
right.
Oh, yeah.
And then you become this addict of, I want to see people have those aha moments.
Yeah.
So it was like, okay, so that's back to where I, when I realized that's where I went to Camp Pendleton, and I was an instructor on the rifle range teaching recruits marksmanship.
Right.
So that's what I did for a couple of years, is I taught hundreds and probably thousands of recruits that were going through boot camp marksmanship. So I was a coach. I was a primary marksmanship instructor. I ran the range, both on the line as well as in the pits where the targets are. And I just continued to have this desire to teach.
So one thing about that that's important, and I've talked about this in another episode, which is one of the best ways to become a strong manager, and this is something they do not teach you in business school, is differentiated learning. Mm-hmm. How do I see someone? I got 10 people in front of me. Each of them is a different shot, right? But each person still needs to get better. And how do I help the skills that this person needs? And how do I communicate to that person what they need?
That's exactly right?
Because this guy, if I yell at him, right, he'll break down.
That's right.
But this woman over here, I can yell at her, and she's a former player, and she played basketball, and she's used to that, and that will actually inspire her to get better. So you've got to figure out differentiated skill distribution and differentiated kind of engagement to get them to the next level.
That's right.
And you're learning that both as a coach, but you're also doing that when you're in the military.
Yep.
That's a skill set that's very difficult to teach on the job. They definitely do not teach it in business school. At least they didn't teach it in my business school.
Didn't teach it in mine either.
But it's one of those skill sets that without it, you actually cannot be a very strong manager.
Yeah.
You have to develop it. It's one of the reasons why I think veterans are actually better positioned to be entrepreneurs, because you have to do that when you're in the military.
Yeah.
That is a requirement of what you do.
Yeah. We meet people where they're at.
Right.
And I think that's a great point, because we can look at a kid and say, okay, well, this kid's left-handed from a big city, you know, never held a long gun in his life. This kid's going to struggle. How do I articulate to him what it is that he needs to learn? What do I need to say, right? So you begin to change your vernacular. You begin to change your approach. You begin to change. And through it all, you start saying, okay, well, I remember I had a struggled shooter
like this
3 cycles ago that I think I'll give this example and really resonate with him, and I'll see that click. Because then I became like, man, I want to try and find out now what it is that I've got to say, or how can I get this? You know, we had guys that were seasoned, that it was like a witch doctor. Like, hey, come on over.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
You've seen all the different types and categories and groups of people that are struggling and had a hard time, difficult shooters. Why don't you work with them? And that's what I eventually became.
Mm-hmm.
I became that person. And then I applied those same principles and applications throughout my life, through business, through jiu-jitsu, through wrestling, through coaching, because kids come with, every human comes with a different level of experience and exposure to whatever it is that they're now coming to you with.
Right.
Hey, I've never shot a weapon.
Right.
Okay, well, I teach concealed carry also.
Right.
So mom, aunt, grandma, right? I have all these people that come from different walks of life, different experience and exposure to this, but they want to know how to handle a firearm.
Exactly.
So what do I have to say to give them the level of comfort and security to feel confident with what I'm saying is true, what I'm saying is safe, and what I'm saying is going to get them to understand and comprehend how they can use this instrument of death safely and carry it with them legally and safely and execute if needed.
But this differentiation is the key to being very successful as a manager. Because what we do as managers is we find, develop, manage talent. Because nothing important is done alone.
Yeah.
Everything requires other people. And unless you can learn to differentiate how you recruit, how you train, how you manage, all those different elements, you can't keep good talent either.
True.
And so, again, another reason why I think the military background is such a good one. Another reason why I think military is a great background for entrepreneurship through acquisition is knowing how to navigate the morass of the bureaucracy that exists in the military.
Sure.
You know, like, the military comes with its own everything. And I will say this, for my son, Gabriel, he was kind of like the Hawkeye, if you're old enough to remember MASH. So if you were about to get deployed, he would buy your RV, he'd buy your motorcycle, he'd buy your car. If you just got in and you wanted a fancy car, he'd sell it to you, right? He was the guy who basically was on the base, connected to everybody. I can get you this, I can get you that. What's crazy is I went out to go visit him in New Mexico where he was stationed. He had a bed on the floor, right? Just one couch, a TV that was sitting on the milk crate. But he had like multiple cars in the driveway that were not his. I mean, they were his, but he didn't drive them because he was just into the transaction. I tell that story, one, because I'm really proud of my son, but because he figured out how to leverage the system in every single way, shape, and form that was possible in a way that would be helpful to him and to others. And when you're in the military and you've been in the military for 20 years, you know, I know you know the difference between, well, if I move to this base, I get an extra X dollars amount for living here. And if my wife moves in, I get another extra amount for this, right? So I say that because understanding systems is actually really important. Mm-hmm. So whether the system is a franchise system, whether the system is a corporate system, whether it's a system that you actually are developing, when you've been in the military, you have been forced to have to learn and adapt in those systems.
Yep.
That is not true for most other people. You know, that's why you going to Cook County and doing that work was seamless because you were just within another system.
Yep.
Probably less complex, actually, than what you had in the military.
Right.
Although from the outside world, government seems more complex. And so just that's a second reason why I think military is well positioned. But a third, it's financial. Most of the folks who are in the military that I've experienced, they go one of two routes. They either like take whatever money they have, and it's basically like it's all going on four black, right? We're about to make 36 to one, or we're about to go home empty handed.
That's right.
Or they are really diligent about how they stock away and they save their money. There are a variety of programs that military personnel are, and veterans in particular, can have accessible to them. I don't know if the military does a very good job of telling you about these programs before you leave, but they exist and they're there. And actually, usually, places have difficulty giving that money away. But even if it's not that instance, between the GI Bill, between different things that you can leverage with banks, there's a way to get access to capital that you've earned that's different than folks that are not in the military. So when you combine the understanding of working with bureaucracies and systems, you combine with the knowledge of managing large groups of people and the differentiation and the access to capital, the only thing that's left is for someone to help guide and teach you, how do I create what they call my buy box? How do I determine what is the criteria of what I need to evaluate to determine is this a deal that I'd be willing to do?
Yeah.
And then someone who can help me put together the advisory team, help me walk through the process of actually executing a deal. Part of what we hope to do is to actually get a whole cohort of veterans, kind of walk everybody through that process, show them this is exactly how you do it, right? So that you can go do it for yourself. You kind of did that on your own. You gutted through it to kind of decide, I'm going to go start this business. I tried to raise this money. I'm going to go figure it out on my own. Talk about Valor Jiu-Jitsu. Talk about kind of the process of how you went through the financing and kind of where you are now.
Sure.
And by the way, I won't steal your thunder, but you have an amazing startup story already, and you're just at the very early stages. So,
yeah. Thank you. So, again, back to it's something that I like. When I began to kind of get to a point where contracting work is great, but it's not sustainable. So it's like, man, what am I going to do? Do I go back to this grind of trying to find another full-time job and either work for a crummy boss or just go through this rejection again, right? Because I had already begun doing that while doing this contract work. And yet again, the magic number, I stopped at 300.
Yeah.
So now I've got more experience and I'm thinking this is going to be that much easier. There's no reason why I couldn't get into a place. It wasn't working out quite the way I wanted to. So I was coaching in Lamont High School, where we live, and my daughter one day reached out to me and said, hey, she knows the passion that I have for the sport of wrestling, and they were starting an all-girls wrestling team.
Wow.
So she texted me and my wife and said, hey, they're going to start a team. We got a meeting after school.
My she daughter wrestling?
She did, yeah.
Wow.
So my heart was, awesome. I was elated. I was like, man, this is, I couldn't.
I did it. I did it.
So she was always, so of the three, she's probably the toughest in terms of she's just tougher than my other two. My son's a black belt with me and teaches at the school, but he just grew up differently. I mean, I know that I was a young dad. No dad's
perfect.
You
were learning.
Yeah.
I told my kids I didn't know what I was doing. Yeah. I did my best.
And I did my best with what I knew and what I had, right? So we'll talk about it in counseling later, right?
Exactly. What therapy's for.
The youngest one, she's just wired differently. And she texted me, and I remember I was probably like jumping up by myself reading this text. And she said, there's a meeting after school. So, okay, great. What are we doing? It says, now it's us,
it's
right?
Us.
What are we doing? So I was part of this team. I went and got my substitute teacher's license. I'm going to be part of the school district. And I said, hey, look, I'm going to substitute teach.
Ruining your daughter's social life. She can't. There's not a single boy in that school who's ever going to come close to your daughter.
That's right. So, and then the head coach was the dean.
Oh, my goodness.
He's the dean of students. So we formed this great bond and relationship. He and I get along really well. All these girls really kind of click to, and they take to me. It was great. Yeah. And I think, you know, despite what they were doing and despite everything that was going on, these girls got to see me love on my daughter.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted more than anything. Right?
Absolutely.
Is to be able to provide a model of what, you know, a trying dad, because not a good dad.
I understand.
A trying dad did.
It's full circle for you.
Yeah.
That's breaking that ancestral bond.
Absolutely.
Right? Making sure you don't pass on that hardship to her and to her children and so forth.
That's right. So I coached. I helped coach the team. I was a volunteer coach. I was there all the time, as much as I could be anyways. And a good friend of mine who I trained with years ago, we got our black belts from the same guy, Christian Uflocker, who's from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Got a tremendous school and academy on the south side of Chicago. So he and I came from there. But he was coaching his daughter, and we had seen each other at a meet. And one of the customs and traditions that we had kind of started is like every Thanksgiving morning when we were training together, we had a group of guys that would just go in and just knock the snot out of each other every Thanksgiving morning about 6, 7 in the morning, and then go lumped up back home and help mom with turkey.
Right.
So we hadn't seen each other in a while. It's like, hey, man, I'm at this academy now. Everybody's kind of like, do you have access to a school? Where are you training at? Where are you training at? So we find out. We go to his place where he's training. We go there Thanksgiving morning. I see him about 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later at a wrestling meet. Hey, what's going on, man? How's it going? I haven't seen you in a couple weeks. What's up? He said, man, I got fired. I'm not at that academy anymore. So I was like, are you kidding me? So we have business to conduct. We're coaching. His team put a whooping on ours.
Yeah, all right.
So then
he'll tell me if I ever see him. Yeah.
So afterwards, we kind of, hey, what's going on, man? What are you going to do? Right? Because immediately my heartstrings are torn because of what I had recently experienced, what I was going through, what I had been through. And I'm kind of empathizing with him. So, hey, brother, what are you going to do? And what he tells me, I'm going to start my own academy.
Good for him.
I said, really?
Right.
You are? He said, yeah. I said, well, if you're serious, call me and we'll talk about it. So he's like, I'm serious.
Yeah, I'm serious now. That's what I told you.
I said, well, call me tomorrow. He called me the next day.
There you go.
And it was in December last year. And we began conversations and sitting down. And I said, okay, well, hey, look, let's talk. If we want to do business together, let's get our wives together, most importantly, because that's the boss, right?
Yes.
In the military, at least in the Marine Corps, the commander, in terms of radio call signs, is always the six. So whatever your unit is,
yeah, right.
She's the six. The first sergeant's the eight. It's eight. There's brevities that's given. So the commander is always the number six. So it's like if your call sign is Mayhem, if it's Grizzly, it's Grizzly Six is the commander. So when you call, I need to talk to the six. I need to talk to Grizzly Six. It means put the commanding officer on the phone.
Yeah.
I call my wife Household Six.
There you go.
Right? Because she's the one that commands the household. So more important than anything, I wanted our wives to get together.
Yeah.
Which wife? Let's go out to dinner with our wives and chat. And I wanted to convey to her that although we would be in business and although it was going to be, you know, partially a livelihood, the relationship that they had was more important to me as his business partner than the business itself. Yeah. And I wanted her to know that, like, hey, I want you to know, this is my wife. This is my gangster of a wife, right, that I've had for 30 plus years. And she is going to be a priority over this business.
Right.
So I want you to know that that's what I'm telling him. And if for whatever reason you feel that he's not treating you that way, then no, it's not me.
Right.
Right. So I wanted to kind of get that out here, not to throw him under the bus, but to know that I was going to be there to help regulate.
That's amazing.
What he was going to be doing and the participation, because I know how that can become.
Well, I'm going to stop and say one thing about that. One of the things when I'm coaching people and talking to them about, you know, whether they're going to buy or they're going to start a business, there are a whole series of things that people use as reasons not to do something.
Sure.
Not that they're not legitimate, but these are objections, right? Time and money, I don't have. Fear and doubt. But the one that they usually forget is their partner, their spouse. Sometimes it's not your spouse. Sometimes I take care of my mother. Sometimes it's a kid, right? But it's some other person, familiar person that you are trying to consider that can be one of the reasons that you decide not to take that risk.
Yeah, for sure.
And the mistake that most people make is that they don't spend enough time doing exactly what you did, which is really engaging that partner and making sure that he or she understands, this is why I'm taking this risk. This is what I'm hoping to get. This is what it means for our relationship. This is how I'm going to honor our relationship in the midst of the fact that I've got this new thing that I've got to do.
Yeah.
And the fact that you did that is amazing and bodes very well for the future for you, because that's one of the areas that most people, and I can speak from experience, I didn't do well enough before. Mm-hmm. It only came after the fact that I really appreciated how important that conversation is that you had. And to have it not just with your wife, but to have it with your partner and his wife really says a lot about how well positioned you are for this business.
Yeah.
So congratulations to you. It's an example that we definitely want to use for others. And I want to talk a little bit about, as we get on in this conversation, how you started Valor, why you decided to locate it where you did. You broke away from your kind of own teacher in order to do this.
Yeah.
And just kind of the story of your startup. I mean, you're only 3 weeks in, than a month in.
This is 3 weeks.
And you've had some success. You're on your way up. But talk a little bit about that as we kind of get beginning to wrap up.
Sure. So just by virtue of us having to look at different places, we knew, just like in real estate, it's location, location, location. We found a location. The circumstances were right. The landscape kind of worked, not just geographically, but the circumstances that the landlord found himself in with that particular piece of property. So it put us in a place of negotiation.
Yeah.
So we were able to kind of leverage some of the things that he needed with what we wanted, and it worked out. It was a great alignment. It worked out well. Then it was a matter of finding the contractor, and that was through someone that we knew. So all of these pieces began to kind of fall into place, but the finance thing was one, and that was a struggle.
Yeah.
Went through SBA, but because I had contracting work behind me, I wasn't at a full-time job.
Yep.
He had just recently lost his job. We struggled with the finance piece. He ended up taking out some of his 401k. I ended up dipping into life savings, and we financed it ourselves. So we knew that we had to get the word out. You've got to become the star quarterback overnight.
This is going to work.
It has to work. So we began to kind of prep the battlefield, which is going back again. How am I going to prep the battlefield? How am I going to get the word out? So, well, social media, and it's free. So we began to kind of document the construction through it all. Like, because who doesn't like progress?
Everybody.
People like a beginning and an end.
Yep.
And I began to leverage that. I said, man, how are we going to do that? Let's let people know in the area that we're here, and let's let them see the beginning and the end. So we begun to kind of track the construction. Oh, look where it's at now, showing before and after pictures, the progress of we got our permit.
Very smart.
Partially because we also wanted to kind of document the process. It's a way of creating a timeline for ourselves. Right? So when I want to replicate it.
When you tell the story about you, I have a thousand different spaces now. It began with this one.
That's right. And we began to kind of document and record those things. So capturing this historical data for ourselves. Well, we got to a point where we were kind of at a stalemate with construction.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, how are we going to pivot this in a way where we continue to keep attraction and still gain followers? So I was like, man, I've got to do something else. What if we introduce the instructors? What if they now know who we are as people?
Very well done.
So I said, well, let's
brand yourself.
Let's create a panel. So we created a panel and had Q&As. Because now you could see the silliness, you could see the seriousness, you could see the different personalities in the instructors. And then just like in any show that you watch on Netflix or Hulu or any of the
you
other.
You get caught up in the personality.
That's right. And you find a character you like.
So is it you or is your partner the evil one? Because someone's got to get voted off the island.
He is.
All right. Yeah, he's the evil one.
He's the evil one.
And have you been able to film your daughter's competition yet? You coaching?
Well, she's gone now.
Okay.
There is footage of us. Yeah, me definitely. All right. Coaching and so when she comes back in the spring, she'll definitely be back on the mats with us. That's awesome. The plan. Yeah.
Well, I interrupted your story because you've also in a very short period of time been able to create some traction around your business. And you said something to me that really stuck, which is like, hey, you didn't say it this way, but I'm playing with house money now.
Sure.
Right. I've generated enough interest that now I can at least cover the cost of marketing for the people that I'm bringing in to get me to my next milestone.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a really good lesson for others to learn, particularly in a service business like this.
Yeah. And that's the thing. So, you know, unfortunately, a lot of these guys in these industries are just meatheads that love to fight. So both a blessing and a curse, right? I am a meathead that likes to fight, but I happen to be a little educated. Right,
yeah, you're a training meathead. Yeah,
and so I've got a little bit of education behind me, and my business partner was a trader. He came up in the trading industry. He didn't work for the Chicago Board of it, but he traded stock options and futures. So he's got a little bit of education behind him as well. So between the two of us, we really kind of understood forecasting. We had an understanding of what we needed to make to meet the bills, what we needed to make, what we wanted a price point to be. So all of these things, right, that I learned in business school.
Exactly.
That matters.
Yeah.
So we start saying, okay, well, hey, look, what is everybody else charging? What should we charge? Where's the value that we have that other people's don't? What's going to be the differentiator between us and them? How can we differentiate ourselves through value? Is it going to be through service? Is it going to be through quality of product? Is it going to be through amenities? You know, we began to kind of really hash this all out, write it all out, and figure out what the good and bad is and what makes us different than everybody else. And that's okay, hey, this is what we're going to build. And we began to kind of the campaign. The airstrike began and we started letting people know who we were, our personalities, where we were going to be, when we were going to open. And then the biggest thing that I think helped us is we created interest in people saving money. Because, hey, look, there's a lot of people out there just like us. You're going to find a lot of other gyms. None of them are going to have an owner that's nearly as handsome as I am.
No, very hard to find.
But we're going to give you a better price. Because if you get in early and you get this founder's price, you're going to lock in. And people were taking advantage of this opportunity because that's what it was.
Yeah.
It offered value. Hey, wait a second. I get something for less. I get the same quality of experience, exposure, opportunity that other competitors have, but for cheaper.
Yep.
There we go.
Oh, I think that's a whole nother podcast to talk a lot about.
Sure.
That idea of how do I make sure that when I contact someone, I maximize the cost of me getting that eyeball and that attention.
Yep.
How do I get that person when they object to actually reconsider? How do I get that person who's bought a little to upsell to a higher amount?
Mm-hmm.
How do I bring that person back who used to use my product? Each of those is a different skill set, all of which are really critical to be smart about this. But I will leave you with this one thought, and we talked a little bit about this as well. You know, you're in the early stages, but this is probably the time to focus on continuing to develop your model. but you're not far in the distance where it's time for you to think strategically about how you grow your business. Mm-hmm. And one of the foundational questions you're going to have to ask yourself is, am I building this to be an empire that I actually control and oversee for a long period of time, so that I'm trying to make my money through pulling out money from the cash flow that I developed from this? Or am I building this into something that's a sellable asset?
I already know the answer. Right?
What's that for you?
It's going to be a sellable asset.
Why? So if it's
because I would much rather be part of a business that's making $1 million and can do it without me than $10 million and require me to be there.
So that's the fact that you have that clarity really helps.
Yeah.
Because the next thing is now, okay, I used my own money to get started and create my platform. But now I need to think through, okay, how do I document, for example, which you did smartly, what's the process of opening? Everyone who wants to do this is going to have to either remodel or open, right? You've now gone through a process of documenting what that looks like, starting with how did I choose the location? How did I negotiate my rate? How did I do the construction and the build out and learn all the lessons, good and bad?
Right.
Now I go to the point of creating all of the processes and matrices that I'm using to run my business. Like, how much will I spend on an eyeball before it doesn't make any sense for me? Mm-hmm. How much do I anticipate, you know, I'm going to give up as an opportunity for that founding member versus the people that come afterwards? But as you start to document, process all this, mm-hmm. you are now creating essentially operations manual that you can use both to create what they call your buy box, the criteria that you use of what you're going to acquire. Mm-hmm. So you might be looking for those businesses that are failing in a lot of the areas that you are, because that shows you there's an opportunity if I buy this to actually, you know, take it up to another level.
Yeah.
Or I'm looking for people that are performing at that level that I can acquire and add on to have a bigger and bigger cash flow. But all of these things are kind of right in line with what you want to do. And that's something that we're happy to try to help you a little bit with, mm-hmm. point you in the right direction to the degree that we can. I just want to thank you for an awesome conversation. And I do want to thank you again for your service.
They paid me the whole time.
Absolutely. And I want to ask you that, you know, I definitely want to come back and use you as an example for other veterans to help give people confidence that it is possible to do exactly what you've done over and over and over again. Because we really believe that that's a population who could be a really important entrepreneurial group that can actually help us going forward. So thank you very much. I appreciate it, man.
Absolutely.
This is great.
Yeah, thank you.